Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis, and this week we're going back to a show we did last year where we get into the beauty of grains and beans with my dear friend, farmer chef Abra Behrens. And we're going to talk baking with national treasure Dory Greenspan. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, I'm just going to say it. Dory Greenspan is one of the greatest cookbook writers alive. And I'm saying that not just because her recipes are great and because she has legions of fans who start clubs to cook through her books every week, but because she does this thing where she can make a completely normal, regular old cook or baker like you or me feel totally at home with a recipe from a legendary French chef. I don't know if she does it, but she does. Anyway, her new book, her 14th, is called Baking with Dory, and it's a treasure trove of good stuff. New ideas, old favorites she's tweaked. She joins us here today. Hey, Dory, I'm so happy to talk with you.
It's so good to be back with you again. Thank you.
It is always such a joy. So I want to ask you something, because it's like a terrible question for anyone else, but I think you'll actually enjoy answering this. So like whenever a cookbook author is interviewed, inevitably someone asks them, what's your favorite recipe? And always, 100% of the time, they say, oh, it's so impossible. It's like asking me to choose which is my favorite child. So I love that in this book, you just said, okay, these recipes are my favorites. Like, I like them all, but these are the ones I really like. And they're like these little collections in the book. So tell me about some of these favorite recipes and why.
Well, you know, it's so strange. I've never done this before. So when I write a book, I work on recipes. I work. And then I only finish a book. I might be still be working on my first book 30 years later, if anyone had let me. I only stop when the editor says your deadline is looming. And for this book, for Baking with Dory, when I listed all the recipes, I realized that I had played favorites, that I had gone heavy on and deep and delicious on like chocolate chip cookies, on brioche, on crusts for pies and tarts, and on pâte à choux, on cream puff dough and meringues. And so I decided to make those a separate section and to call them my sweethearts. And it was so much fun to finally come out loud and say, I love these recipes.
Okay, but so brioche, chocolate chip cookies. We can talk about cookies later because there is a controversial move that you've made in this book by tweaking an old favorite recipe of everyone's. But let's start with the brioche, for instance.
Okay.
Why was the brioche among your favorite recipes?
So I was so proud of myself when I learned to make brioche. Brioche is a beautiful dough. It's beautiful to make as you watch it change as you're working it. I love the dough. I love the taste of it. I love how when you pull it, it just stretches. And it's really a versatile dough. But I hadn't really used it for much. I'd made brioche buns and I'd made brioche loaves in different shapes. And now I got to play with it and I made sticky buns out of it. And babka, I had never made a babka before.
I haven't either.
First time. You haven't made one?
No.
Oh,
the recipes. I mean, I also haven't written 14 cookbooks based on baking, but yeah.
Oh, but I hope you'll make this one. It's so good. And I also use the brioche dough to make kind of a cheese babka. Mm. You know, it's interesting to take one thing and work on it. To focus on something. And I find that the more you're focused, the more creative you can be with it. And so it was like that with brioche.
Yeah. So brioche, like you said, it's a beautiful dough. This is a very, very rich
bread dough. I think the technical or even like legal French definition, right? It has to be 50% butter.
Don't throw numbers at me, Francis. I don't know. Is that true? I've never heard that.
I have heard that before. If you tell me you've heard differently, I would trust you rather than me. But I have heard the legal French definition of brioche is that it must contain 50% of the weight, I think, of the flour in butter. But anyway, when you, to your point, I've seen it made, and when it's in the mixer and you're adding that butter chunk by chunk, it almost becomes this beautiful spider web, this glowing yellow spider web. And
exactly.
And typically is made into loaves or buns, but I love the idea of a sticky bun with it.
It's pretty yum.
Oh my God. And tell us about like the chocolate chip cookies. Like why 30 years into your baking cookbook career, you wanted to say, hey, let's really look at chocolate chip cookies again.
Well, I love chocolate chip cookies. I love them when you don't use chips. I like them when you've taken your favorite chocolate and chopped it up and used all the pieces. They're all different sizes and the dust, so they look tweety. And so I started with what I call my classic chocolate chip cookie and started thinking about other cookies that I really love, some recipes that people have given me for chocolate chip cookies that I've loved. Mm-hmm. And as with the brioche, you realize that you can make small changes, even big changes, and have the cookie have a different texture, have a flavor that lingers, have a look that's not the same. I mean, one of the cookies is made in a mini muffin tin so that it gets all caramelly around the edges.
Oh, wow. And it was just you playing. Because this goes into my other question, right? Like, this is your 14th book. You don't look a day over 7 cookbooks, my dear. But how do you stay inspired? 150 recipes in this book.
So I stay inspired because there isn't a moment when I don't think I'm lucky to be doing this work. I love doing this work. And the work itself inspires ideas. But this was a somewhat difficult book because one of the things that's always inspired me is travel. The opportunity to see new ingredients, new markets. And this was a book that was written primarily during, COVID confinement. I have some recipes that come from the travel before times. But I think I realized once again that it is the work that inspires. As I'm working, I have ideas. So one of the things, my husband is always saying, it's enough, because I'm always saying, what if I finished a recipe? I love the recipe. And I'll look at it and say, what if? Don't you think it would be good if I added, cardamom? Or what if I tried this as a cake instead? So I'm always thinking, it's the work inspires the work inspires the work.
I love hearing you say that because I do have this idea that, not about writing cookbooks particularly, but I guess I don't need to like get so deep into this like you are my therapist. But like, when I was younger, like when I was a teenager, I hated being bored. Like, being bored was the worst torture. And at some point I realized, when I was more mature, you can only really be bored if you've stopped learning how to ask the right questions of things. And if you learn to ask questions of things, like literally anything could be, bottomlessly interesting. The salt shaker on your table, if you start asking, well, where does salt come from? And what's the chemical composition of salt? And how is this salt made? And how did you make the glass to make the salt shaker? Things like that. And I love that what you're saying is, the more you're cooking, the more you're baking, the more you're writing recipes, the more questions you have, and you learn to ask more questions, and it just springs forth into new ideas.
You don't need a therapist. I think you've solved this one. But I know I've said this before, and maybe even to you, but I think of this every day. When I worked with Julia Child, we were out one day, and she said to me, "We're lucky." And I looked at her and, we were kind of questioningly, because there were a million reasons that one of us could be lucky. And I thought it was me being out with her. but she said, we're lucky because we work in food. And that means we'll never stop learning. There's always something to learn. And I think about that all the time.
Yeah, that's totally true.
Yeah.
It's totally true. And with that, let's go to some callers, because there are people who, you know, when we told you would be on, they really want to learn from you. So you ready to take some callers with me?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Let's go to Andrea.
Hi, this is Andrea from Edmonds, Washington. And my question is, what cookie from baking or from any other place would you recommend for a cookie box? I make them every holiday, and I'm running out of ideas this year. Anything would help. Thanks.
So Andrea wants to bake a Dory Greenspan cookie or 12. What would you say? What should she bake?
Well, Andrea, rather than give you a specific cookie recipe, though I'd be happy to do that, I'm thinking about some ideas in general. So, for instance, have you ever put biscotti in your cookie box? I love biscotti because, you know, they're really good keepers, but they're also a different shape from other cookies. So they look pretty in the box. They add, you know, a little textural difference. I love shortbread, and shortbread also good keepers. And you can make shortbread a million different ways. And you can also, if you do it as a slice and bake, you can put sugar around the edges or spices around the edges. And that looks pretty in the box. Star cookies, brownies. Have you ever thought of putting brownies in a box? So what I like about, well, I love brownies in general, but you can change the shapes. And I think sometimes with selections of cookies, just changing the shape of something adds a pop, adds some interest.
Yeah, totally. I love that. Well, let me ask in her stead, let me ask you about a specific recipe, because the World Peace Cookie, a Dory Greenspan signature, you know, Googled a million times, the cookie that launched 1,000 cookie tins. In its original form, the World Peace Cookie is a chocolate sablée, so like a shortbread-style cookie, but chewy because it has brown sugar and it has chopped bittersweet chocolate and sea salt on top.
In it.
Oh, in it. Right. In it.
Right.
And now in your new book, Baking with Dory, you have a World Peace 2.0. How'd you mess with it?
Well, you know, it's so funny because I was going to say to Andrea, I think you would love making 2.0, so... Thank you, Francis. So the original recipe came to me over 20 years ago from Pierre Hermé, the French pastry chef. And I've been asked to change it, and I never have, because it's just a perfect cookie. Some people have made a mint version of it. Some people have put peanut butter chips in it. That's all good. But I wasn't going to change my version. And then Charlotte Druckman was working. She's an author, a writer, a cookbook author. Was working on a book called Women in Food, and she asked if I would tweak the World Peace Cookie for her book, and I said no. And then I said yes, because okay. I had this idea that I could match ingredients to the characteristics that I really admire in women. And that was just, I mean, if you want to talk about inspiration, that was so much fun to do, to try and kind of personalize ingredients that way. And so I added some rye flour for groundedness, for earthiness. I added piment espelette or cayenne or another spicy pepper for, you know, kind of excitement and spark.
Sure.
I added cocoa nibs for strength. And I added freeze-dried raspberries, which have such a sharp flavor, for kind of verve and a little bit of sassiness. And I love this new cookie.
Oh, God, that sounds so good. I'm an awful baker, but the beautiful thing about the World Peace Cookie is it's not a difficult cookie to make. So I might even try my hand at a 2.0.
Francis, you could do this. It's a slice and bake cookie. You can do it.
That's Dory Greenspan joining us today. She's the author of many, many books. Her latest is called Baking with Dory. She'll be back with more in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread.
You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Grant Slam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So we're talking about baking with the great Dory Greenspan today, and we are taking some of your questions with her. Let's get back to it. Okay, let's go to another caller.
Hi, my name is Airdrie. I am 6. Can you tell me how to use different varieties of apples and how many apples there are in the world?
Oh my God,
that is the sweetest. That's so good. Oh, that is such a 6-year-old question. Can I do this very straightforward thing? And also, how many apples are there in the entire world?
Okay, so wait, just for a second. You were talking about thinking about things, looking at things, asking questions about them. I have a feeling that Erti is never bored. Yeah. I think she's a question asker.
I love it.
But so let's good. Answer her question.
Sure. Now, how would you categorize apples in for baking?
Gee, that's interesting. I think of them as either sweet or tart, juicy or dry, firm or soft.
Okay.
And so if I'm making a pie, I prefer to have juicy, sweet apples in it. And I might throw a firm, tart one in just for the fun of it. And if I'm baking apples, I like, you know, bigger apples. I hate the word mealy, but mealy apples are good for if you're just, you know, making an old-fashioned baked apple. But usually, just mixing up a bunch of apples in a pie or a cake will give you something really delicious and interesting. And I'm leaving the hard question for you, Francis. How many kinds of apples are there in the world?
I have no idea. I couldn't even Google the answer because I'm sure apples are one of those crops where there's constantly new varieties being crossbred and all that. But I have truly no idea how many varieties of apples are in the world. I mean, I think at one point I read in like the UK alone, there were over 3,000 varieties of apple or something like that. But but I love that idea of mixing apples because I do, my family and I, we go apple picking every year. It's a sweet tradition that my wife went to this one apple orchard with her family since she was a little kid. And so now we take our kid there and it's very sweet. And we go and we pick and I never look at, you know, the sign of like the particular stand we're in. So we got some here, we got some there, and we always come home and like, I don't know which one of these are good for eating, which one of these are good for baking. And so we do, when we make the pie, to your point, we just throw them together. And some of them, you know, do that thing where they cook down in like applesauce, mm-hmm. which, you know, by itself would probably not be super satisfying in a pie, because then you have applesauce pie and that's a little weird. But if that's mixed with some crunchy ones that do keep their shape, and some crisper mm-hmm. ones, and some that are sweeter and some that are tartar, it's really cool.
Yeah, mix it up.
Mix it up. All right, let's do another fall produce superstar. Let's go to Rena.
Hi, my name is Rena from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Fall colors are in full effect here, and it really makes me want to maximize my oven use, making lots of pumpkin-based baked goods that I see on my Instagram feeds. My issue is this. I'm not a fan of roasted pumpkin. It's watery and it's kind of bland. I have three butternut squash, two delicata squash, and a beautiful acorn squash my CSA last week, and I'm wondering if I can substitute any of those for pumpkin. I find that these squash have a more full-bodied flavor and go really well with pumpkin spice type flavors. Please help. Thank you.
Yeah. I love that when Rena was asking her questions, she's like, I have two. Oh, well, I have three now. Butternut. Like, they proliferate like on your counter, or like there's like a magical squash elf who just like came by and dropped one down. It's like, oh, God, I have another one. What are you doing?
Well, so what do you think, Francis?
You know, I have to tell you, I also like pumpkin things. I like squashes. I'm a squash fan, pro squash. I have never actually cooked a pumpkin. I've always just thought they were really watery and flavorless and not very sweet at all. Whereas a butternut or an acorn has so much flavor and has a natural sweetness. And butternut, I think, is a little denser than an acorn squash. But I like to use them in anything you would use for pumpkin, like cook them, puree them. I think you'd probably really like the results. But I'm going to be honest, if I was making a pumpkin pie, I'm opening a can of pumpkin pie filling.
Okay, is now the time to say, so would I? Oh, dear, I've said it. I've said it. Too late to take it back. Yeah. Yeah. But I have some ideas about those squash that are proliferating on Rena's counter. So I've made a recipe for years that I've called pumpkin stuffed with everything good. The recipe was given to me by a friend in Paris whose sister used to grow pumpkins, and she had two little kids, and she would carve the kids' names on the pumpkins. And so when the pumpkins grew, the names got bigger and bigger. And then she would stuff these pumpkins for the kids. And one way to stuff it, the pumpkin, is breadcrumbs and onions, and I like to put sausage or bacon or ham in there, but you don't need to. The other day I did one with kale and apples with the bread. And then you put it in the oven and bake it until the pumpkin is soft and the filling is all bubbly and delicious. It's a great dish. It's so good. That would be great with the acorn squash. That would make a perfect little container for anything. You could make it with rice. I did one with rice and coconut milk a little while ago that was really interesting. You use the pumpkin as a container, and everything roasts in it, and then you scrape the pumpkin so you have that. I think roasted pumpkin is delicious, so you've got the roasted pumpkin mixed with the bread, the cream, the seasonings, the other vegetables. That's a fun thing to do with squash.
Yeah, I love that. And like butternut squash a little bit less so, because butternut squash, the skin's a little more delicate. Usually I would peel that and dice it and roast it or you know, cut it into wedges or whatever. I would roast the pieces. And there's not much to fill in a butternut because it's so...
Right, it's long, you know, rather than bulbous.
But an acorn or... like a Hubbard, although those are huge, and you know, not everyone gets those. Or a kabocha. Oh my God, kabocha is...
Oh, wouldn't that be great?
It's phenomenal. Kabocha squash is probably my favorite. It's so sweet, and it's savory, and it's rich and creamy and nutty and buttery. It's such an incredibly delicious food. Yeah, but to fill that with bread and cream and cheese and nuts and greens and bake the whole thing until the whole thing comes together, that's...
Oh, cheese. Did you say cheese? Because I think I forgot to say that. And that's an important element because you want that pull it up and it kind of pulls along, you know, that melty.
Yes.
So you want some of that. But what happens in the oven changes. That's so obvious. But if treated properly, you can treat it with love. You can get great flavor by roasting those squash.
Yeah. All right, Dory. Well, it has been such a pleasure. I love that we started with baking and then we came back to savory food, but we're still baking.
We're still baking. Yeah. So it's kind of what happened as I was working on the book. I thought I was doing a savory book, but I ended up baking.
Here we go. New cookies, new pies, new cakes. I love it. Dory, it was so fun to talk with you.
I always love talking to you. Thank you, Francis.
Dory Greenspan's latest book is called Baking with Dory, and she left us with a great recipe for her caramel apple crisp. You can find it at splendidtable.org. So hey, if you have a buddy who's a mechanic, you're texting them the second you hear something go clank in your car, right? Your doctor friend gets an email every time your kid starts coughing. Well, don't you wish you had a friend who, say, is a chef, maybe was a farmer at one point, is currently a beloved cookbook writer, and you can have them for advice anytime you're thinking about dinner? Well, you have that friend. Abra Behrens is all those things, and she is a friend to everyone. All you have to do is open up one of her books. Her first one is called Roughage. It was all about vegetables and hundreds of things to do with them, and it's just such a lovely read. And she has a new one called Grist. It's all about grains, beans, and other heroes of your pantry. Hey, Abra.
Hey, Francis.
I am so super excited to talk with you, and I'm so excited to talk about grains.
It's funny that most people, when they say that, I think are making fun of me, but I don't think you are, actually.
No, I really love grains. I truly, truly love grains. But actually, okay, in all seriousness, well, maybe I will tease a little bit, but you know, I've seen you cook, right? We've had the opportunity to cook together over the years, and I totally remember this very specific moment when I was visiting you when you were the chef of a cafe, like a lunch counter inside this produce market. And I remember you showing me around the market, and like you had all these like gorgeous tomatoes to work with. And like I remember you looked so happy standing next to a 5-foot stack of tomatoes. And so I'm reading the intro to your book Grist, and you're right in the very beginning that the best meals come from ingredients you're excited to cook with. Mm. And so I get the romance of tomatoes, but how did you come to decide that barley is exciting?
Well, honestly, I think like all ingredients, we have to thank the farmers for it. And I am the chef at Grainer Farm, which is in Three Oaks, Michigan. And I started there in 2017. And lucky for me, in 2016, a man named Wesley Reith joined the team. And over the course of a couple of years, really built our grain program. So we went from farming about 10 acres of rye, sort of as an experiment to have distilled at a local distillery, to just shy of about 400 acres. And that's certified organic small grain. And the term small grain encompasses, you know, everything from wheat, rye, barley, oats, kernza. We do heirloom corn and non-GMO soy, things like that. And so Wes and Andrew Harris, who joined our team a couple years later, really started growing these grains, and I was interacting with them. And so I just suddenly realized like, oh, there's this like humble little thing, a wheat berry in our kitchen. And I ended up sprouting some with some other store-bought grains for like I think I was making like a loaf of bread or something. And the wheat berries got those little tails overnight, basically. And they're just so much more alive.
Yeah.
And then also the black beans that we grow were like no black beans I'd ever had before. So it really, I credit Wes and Andrew for kind of revitalizing an interest in a new set of ingredients for me.
Oh, that's so interesting. Like I said, in all seriousness, I really love beans and I really love grains. And you know, I can recognize that there are better versions of these than others. But at the end of the day, they still feel like, oh, that stuff in your pantry, that stuff that sits there kind of inert. And I love that you said, oh, when you're sprouting it, the grains that you have, like, came right out of, you know, the fields over there. Mm-hmm. They were literally more alive. They sprouted. They actually, like, grew in water, like, instantly.
Yeah. It's interesting because grains and legumes have seasons, but we don't think of them that way. They do seem like those sort of staples that you just have day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And so they're really easy to kind of take for granted. And I think that's an interesting counterpoint to when we talk about seasonal produce, in that, like, you know, asparagus season is so short and you got to love it and, you know, eat as much asparagus until you can't really stand eating any more asparagus. And, you know, beans aren't really that way, but they do have seasons and there is this sort of depth to them. And then I think what you're describing too is this other thing that kind of dawned on me as I was writing, was that all of these things are seeds, you know, and the tomato plant is the fruit that has a bunch of seeds inside and it's trying to get people to eat it so that then they'll, you know, eat some of those seeds and pass it on with some fertilizer and then grow the next generation. And these are that. And you could wax poetic about it for a really long time. Just that they're so complete. And then we get to kind of take the nutrients that they're planning to grow a whole plant with and ingest it. And that felt really remarkable in its unremarkableness.
Yeah. So let's get into cooking some of these things. You know, a pot of beans is a beautiful thing, but I think if you're going to cook a pot of beans, like, you can cook a pot of beans, right? And then boom, you have 8 cups of cooked beans. And again, even as someone who loves them, that becomes an intimidating amount of food. So I love that you have this recurring feature in your book that's literally titled A Week's Worth of This Stuff Without Being Bored. So how, like, what are your ideas for keeping a pot of black beans fresh as you're sort of moving through a few days of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets into this idea of batch cooking. And the idea was that, well, actually, more accurately, my sister once was texting me every day of the week saying I made like 2 gallons of lentil soup. And then each day it was like bemoaning lentil soup more and more. And by the final day, she was like, I think I need to throw this away. I was like, don't throw it away. Put it in the freezer. You'll have it again someday. But then it made me realize that these ingredients are really versatile. And that's one of their like main attributes. Mm-hmm. But if you bring it all the way to lentil soup, then you're sort of locked in to what that is. But if you were to cook off, you know, a big pot of lentils or a big pot of beans, you have a primary ingredient that you can then kind of dress up differently. And so for black beans, you know, on day one, I tend to cook black beans with some smoked paprika, a bit of cumin, some chili flakes. So you have a depth of flavor that's there.
And just in water.
Yeah, just in water. I kind of stopped using chicken stock and veg stock. In restaurants, we always cooked grains in stocks, but I sort of prefer it without at this point. And honestly, I have to get chicken stock. I'm going to make something else.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so just straight water and then enough water to cover it. We can get into the soaking question in a second. Enough water to cover. You boil them. They're tender. And then I usually add salt at that point and then let them sit in that liquid so that they then absorb all of that salt all the way to the center. Means you can use a little bit less salt because they sit for a bit longer. And then I would use those beans probably the first night or the next day, you know, as the main feature because we just got excited about cooking them. So let's show them off. Yeah. And then the next day, maybe I'll tuck them into something like a quesadilla where I really want to eat melted cheese and the black beans make it like, you know, feel a little more something. And then day three, I have all of this liquid that they've cooked in. And that liquid is so flavorful and it's so rich. And so you can use that. I started using that as the basis for a lot of soups. It's a thing called pot liquor, which, you know, I have a funny time with homonyms or homophones. I actually can't remember. And so I thought when someone said pot liquor, they were saying L-I-C-K-E-R, like you would lick it. But it's technically L-I-Q-U-O-R. But either way, makes a great soup. Anything that you're going to sop up with bread, or I've used them sometimes as a base for braises. So if you're going to slow cook like lamb shank or something like that, adding that black bean liquid to it.
Like instead of a chicken stock, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So it's really versatile. So I would probably make a soup, probably something that goes with black beans, like, you know, sweet potatoes or carrots or, you know, parsnips, something like that, make a soup. Then at that point, you still probably have some beans. And so I've been making a lot of, I really love purees, which feel like sort of the funny world of I'm not in a restaurant, but I don't feel uncomfortable pulling the food processor out as long as I only have to do it every once in a while. And so I'll take the rest of the beans and kind of whiz them up, maybe with a little bit of olive oil, and make a really smooth, almost like a hummus. I mean, it's effectively the same as a hummus, but just with black beans, and then put that on, you know, any number of things, use it to dip vegetables in,
or it's like a base of a plate, and you can like roast a chicken thigh and put it on top. And yeah, that's like a beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. We're talking with chef, former farmer, and author Abra Behrens. Her first book, Roughage, was a James Beard Award finalist. Her new book is called Grist, a practical guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes. We'll be back with more with her in just a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed up breakfast burrito to a late night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Our guest right now, Abra Behrens, may be more excited about wheat berries than you are, but not for long. Because our new book, Grist, is going to make you go gaga for grains. Pump for pulses. If I can think of another word for beans, I would say that. Anyway, let's get back to our chat with her. Okay, so you mentioned we can talk about soaking later. So let's talk about soaking. Soaking beans. Yeah? No?
Soaking beans. Yeah, I mean, it depends. So here's the deal with soaking beans. What soaking does is it rehydrates them. So we've talked about how these are seeds. Seeds go from their fresh state to a dried state to preserve them. Mm-hmm. Or you can refrigerate or freeze them, but really we dry them and then rehydrate them in order to eat them. So what soaking does is it gives you a jump on that process, and it rehydrates the beans so that you cook them in a little bit less water. Because if you think about the water has to get into the bean either before or during the cooking process. So if you don't soak them, you should use twice as much liquid when you're boiling them so that they can absorb that water. The other thing, and I think the reason that we've all been told that we have to soak beans is because up until recently, most folks were not using dried beans that are on the fresher end of the spectrum. Mm. And when I was talking with some folks who are, you know, kind of retail food experts, I was told that the average life of a bean from the grocery store shelf have an age of about 5 years. So they get mixed in these big batches from different farms. So even though the beans are dried, they're going to get drier over the course of that 5 years. And also they're getting mixed with beans from different years. And so if you've ever cooked a pot of beans and had some of them go to mush, some of them are still super hard, it's because they're all different ages. And soaking kind of acts as an equalizer.
Oh, right on.
And it also speeds the time. So the older your beans are, the longer they'll take to cook. And so if you soak them, you're sort of jump starting that process. So it's a good rule of thumb to do. That said, now that I'm often getting beans either from our farm or from the folks at Rancho Gordo or Anson Mills or, you know, and Zorsoon out of Iowa. Mm-hmm. I am almost never soaking those beans, mostly because I'm sort of a bad planner. And even when I do have good plans to soak beans and then make them the next day, then it's like, oh, let's go to the bar instead, you know? And so it just, they end up sitting. I'm just kidding. We don't go to the bar anymore, but you know what I mean? So even the best laid plans get foiled. And so I just now at this point pretty much cook dried beans, but soaking never hurts, but, as long as
yeah, and the alternative is you just throw them in the water and just simmer them for a little bit longer.
Exactly. I thought you were going to say the alternative is a frozen pizza. And I was like, well, that's usually true.
Why not? Put your beans on your frozen pizza. It'll make it really healthy.
You know, that actually would be delicious.
No doubt. Okay, so let's go to grains. Mm-hmm. So since we're talking about bean cooking basics, let's do some grain cooking basics. So even when I was like starting to become like a fairly confident cook, I remember being really nervous about cooking white rice. I was always afraid like, oh, it's going to be too much water, too little water. Just the idea of overcooking a pot of rice was like, it was so horrifying that I just wouldn't even do it. But I imagine people will feel that way about grains, especially if they're not familiar with farro or wheat berries or rye berries. And they just might be looking at this thing and be like, what do I do? So what do we do?
It's funny that you liken it to rice, because that's actually where it all started, was that I was talking with a fellow cook, Allison Scott, and I said, oh, what's the ratio for rice again? Is it 4-1? Is it 3-1? She was like, oh, I don't even bother with that anymore. I just boil it like pasta. And I was like, oh, that's so smart. I just started doing that. And then it, you know, kind of became clear that you could do that with almost any grain, is just simply boil it. And so get a big pot of water going. The more water you have, the faster it will come back to a boil, which is, I think, more important for some of those delicate things like pasta, but it certainly is a good practice for these, salted water generally. And then boil it until, when you bite into it, it isn't unpleasant to have in your teeth. I sort of joke, but that's really the truth. It's like just until it's tender. And some things cook remarkably fast, like something like buckwheat. I don't know why I thought that buckwheat would take like an hour to boil, but it's really fast. It's like 12 minutes. And so it's good to, like, if you have a package that has instructions on it, it's good to reference that. But yeah, I pretty much just boil stuff until it looks like it's done. And then in general, the bigger the grain, the longer it'll take if it's in its whole state. So like you mentioned farro, that's a confusing one because it comes as unpurled or unpolished, semi-pearled, and then fully pearled. And what that is it's taking the outside structure of the grain and pulling that away. So pulling some of the bran away, which is sort of like the tough exoskeleton of, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, we could go into the weeds on grain anatomy, but it's basically the
that's what people came here for.
Like brown rice versus, I know it sounds so appealing when I say it like that. Yeah, it's like brown rice versus white rice. The same is true for most other grains. Right. And so the less work that the water has to do to penetrate the center of the grain, the faster it cooks. That's what that translates to.
Yeah.
But wait, so I want to know what your method for cooking rice is.
Oh, for cooking rice?
Because you said that you've got it back now and you really, now you're happy and confident cooking
rice. Yeah, I put it in my rice cooker.
You know what's funny is that my favorite part of these books was interviewing producers and growers. And I did an interview with Rachel Roche, who's a rice grower down in Louisiana. And I was like, yeah, so how do you cook your rice? And she told me all the things that she puts with it. And I was like, no, like, how do you cook it? And she was like, oh yeah, I'm Cajun. We eat a lot of rice. We have a rice cooker and it comes out perfect every time. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I should maybe have that part of the chapter.
No. This is amazing. I'm so glad you said that, because Cajuns were the first white people I ever saw who like would own rice cookers also. And it was like, wow, really? You guys get those too? but yeah, like I just grew up with a rice cooker. If I do cook rice in a pot, my ratio is, at this point, it's changed over time. At this point, it's at most 1.5 water to 1 part rice. It's more like 1.25. And in my rice cooker, I could actually go down to like 1-1 now.
Interesting.
Which I thought was impossible. I dared to go down on my water ratio, and it actually comes out like a little bit chewier, a little bit nicer. So I actually like a 1-1, between 1.5 to 1-1. And if I do it in a pot, actually what I do is I do it in the oven.
Oh.
Usually if I'm doing that, I'm toasting the rice in a little bit of oil or butter or fat, really nice and aromatic, throw in the water. It's probably going to boil right away because the pot's already super hot. Mm-hmm. If not, just bring it to a boil, throw a lid on it, and throw it in a 325 oven, 350 oven for 13 minutes, and it's perfect.
Interesting.
Every time. That's for like a long grain white rice or like a jasmine rice or even like a shorter grain white rice.
Are you a pilaf person? Are you a rice pilaf person?
I like a pilaf, yeah. I mean, I love rice. I'll eat rice in every form except mushy. Every form except for overcooked. Mm.
But then there's congee, and there's all, like, rice porridge, which is so delicious, and that's mushy rice. So
yeah, that's like a soup. You know,
I think you're wrong.
It's fine. It's okay. So okay, now we have a beautiful pot of grains. Maybe it's wheat berries. Maybe it's farro. Maybe it's barley. What do you like to do?
Well, I think it's similar to the beans. It's about figuring out other attributes to play up besides volume. And I think grains in my book that you... Right. But honestly, I mean, that's the truth. I feel like at least I grew up with these things being filler, you know, mm-hmm. They were the kind of thing that rounded out the plate and made you not hungry at the end, which is certainly a good reason to eat them. And so, yeah, I would say the first day that I boil them, they're probably going to be the starch on the plate. And then the next day, oh, this is my favorite thing to do with grains, actually, is I really have gotten into marinating stuff. I mean, again, we don't go to the bar anymore, so we're marinating stuff. I'll usually boil enough grains. So maybe I'll do like 2 or 3 cups of the, you know, uncooked grain to start. And then I'm going to siphon off a cup or two of that while they're still warm. Mm. And then just take whatever random vinaigrette I have and just dump that on, or like pickles. Like if you've got sauerkraut or kimchi or any of those things, anything that's super acidic, just dump it on the still warm greens. Mm. And then as they cool, they'll soak those flavors up. And it's sort of akin to like a pasta salad, you know, the next day. So it's going to be a way to eat them either room temperature or cold that has a different set of flavors with it. Because really, I mean, these ingredients are wonderful on their own, but they also, you know, are really great supports for other flavors. So I'll usually do that, and then I'll have that for lunch over the course of the week. And then that still leaves me with like 4 cups of grains to eat through. And so one of the other things we'll do a lot is fry them. And that is usually just in a frying pan with a good amount of a fat, something like olive oil or chicken fat or, you know, butter, any of those things. Yeah. I mean, we could have a whole thing about schmaltz too, but, and so getting that pretty hot, dry off the grains as much as possible so they don't spit at you when they hit the hot fat, but then you're basically just crisping them up, and, they lend this amazing texture to things. And so, you know, I'll do something like a bunch of roasted roots or a big, you know, shaved vegetable salad or a green salad or something like that. And then just like a scattering of those over the top. And it's such a surprising way to have them.
So they're not the base of the dish. You're using like crisp up as a component, maybe like a texture thing.
Yes, very good point. An entire salad made out of fried grain often is unpleasant to eat. It's a little bit like eating a bowl of gravel. But when you get those little pops, I know, it's the real magic of this book is making things that you don't sound good, but then you're like, oh, I guess I'll try it. That seems weird. and so, yes, we're kind of differentiating between volume and texture. So if, you know, a traditional grain bowl is a significant amount of volume of a grain that's like soft and warming and inviting, and then, you know, flip that equation and make it something that is going to pack a punch texturally.
Okay. Well, since you brought up grain bowls, I know I was joking with you before, oh, let's just trade grain bowl ideas for 30 minutes. I know they are like, you know, the scourge of cafe menus all over the country now, but I love a grain bowl. I make them a lot at home. My grain bowls are very vegetable based, like roasted broccoli, roasted cabbage, you know, some beets, you know, whatever the case may be. And usually it's a lot of odds and ends. It's like, oh, if I roasted broccoli for dinner last night, the leftovers of that, and I had beets from the night before, okay, that's fine.
Well, I mean, those are pretty good starting blocks. But I do think it's about playing with either texture or something. I mean, honestly, it's probably acidity too. I think grains as a whole have this sort of crunchy hippie granola like reputation, sure, I guess, yeah. Where people just think they're going to have to like chew them for an hour and that they're not going to taste of anything. And so I think anything that foils that, so if that's something like some really nice creamy cheese, like, you know, mozzarella or like a goat cheese or something like that, and then different textures.
Yeah.
I also think herbs are a really important way to add pops of flavor.
Yeah.
They're not acidic in the way that's going to kind of make you like pucker up, but at the same time, they add these like really intense flavors.
Yeah, it's like fresh. There's like a liveliness
Exactly.
Yeah. And like, what about like a dressing, condiment?
Well, and that's the funny thing too, is that, so I'm a big condiments person. I don't know if we've talked about this before.
The whole first chapter of your book is all condiments. I love it.
Yeah. When people say you open your fridge and it's just condiments, and that's like not a positive. I've never understood that, because it's like, well, yeah, that's the backbone of my cooking is, I mean, not ketchup really, but like, lots of different vinaigrettes and dressings and things like that, because it makes everything just so fast and so tasty. And so a lot of times anything like, okay, here's a question for you, regional. Is jardinera a thing in New York?
Or where, oh, you know, sure. Where like, like a tart vegetable pickle.
Yeah. Like kind of spicy.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I had never heard of it until moving to Chicago. I had also never heard of a thing called beefs or going out for beefs.
Yeah.
They're these like thinly sliced shaved beef sandwiches that are on like hoagie rolls, and there's peppers. You can either get sweet or hot. And then there's this magical thing called gravy bread, where they they literally just dunk the hoagie roll in the juice, like the jus, I guess is the proper way to say that, of this marinated beef. But then they top it with jardinera, or jardinera. I don't know. There's a million different ways to say it. But it's like a traditionally Southern Italian pickled vegetable relish. And that's something I feel like I've been spooning over everything. Or something as simple as parsley and lemon and olive oil. It's so simple, but it really adds so much flavor. And you could put some nuts in there, like, you know, some crunched up almonds or pecans or sunflower seeds or something like that. But just kind of these like chunky rigs. That's what we've always called them. My friend Erin always says, I was like, what is a rig? Have we ever talked about that? And she was like, I think it's just sort of an undefinable, delicious sauce that's also kind of chunky. And I was like, I'm in. I'm 100% into that.
You're selling that too, Abra. Okay, so we're going to rig up our grain bowls.
With something
grains,
chunky.
Vegetables, something rich like cheese, something fresh like herbs, maybe a vinaigrette or some kind of dressing or condiment to give it some more flavor. We're going to finish it with crunchy nuts. And boom, that is going to be an amazing meal.
This is why you work in actual food media. Because that sounded delicious.
We got there. We made our grain bowl.
Yeah.
It has been so much fun to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Same, Francis. And thanks for having me.
Abra Behrens is the author of Grist, A Practical Guide to Cooking Grains, Beans, Seeds, and Legumes. You can find her recipe for sweet rice porridge with dried cherries and five spice at splendidtable.org. Well, that is our show for this week. Hope you loved it. And remember, if you ever have any cooking questions for us, record them as a voice memo on your phone and send them to us. contact@splendidtable.org. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Chaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.